Cape Talk.
Health and wellness.
Always a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Darren Green, looking very summery this afternoon and quite appropriate because we're talking summer health.
Indeed, holiday season's upon us. It's come so quickly.
Yeah, it can't come quickly enough if you ask me. But we're going to be talking about things to be aware of in the holidays, the sun, the hydration, the bugs that are going around.
Yes.
And I thought we'd start today with the bug that's got quite a few people quite worried, Darren, and just get a bit of background info on Listeria because
obviously
earlier this week we had the health minister announcing there is an outbreak of Listeria. At least 36 people have died in the country, more than 500 cases confirmed across South Africa, and a few people concerned because they don't really know much about it. So
the name is not a pop. It's not like staphylococcus or streptococcus, you know. It's not one that everyone knows about. I think even a lot of medical students will remember Listeria as the one that they forgot in the exam. But anyway, so it's what we call a zoonosis. In other words, the bacteria is transferred to us by animals and animal products.
Okay.
So where do you get it from? You get it from things like raw unpasteurized milk. You get it from animal products, whether that be beef, poultry, or pork, and it can also be in the soil. So you can think about vegetables growing in the soil, carrots, a bunch of carrots growing in the soil, and how that soil and the fertilizer, where all that comes from. I mean, the chain is so massive.
Yeah.
So you've got to look at all that. So and the big thing is how it's actually denatured or killed is actually by heat, quite interestingly. That's obviously before it gets to a stage where it causes a bacteremia, where it's multiplying at endless rates.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that up to 10% of people have Listeria in the gut.
Really?
Anyway, so demonstrating the presence of Listeria in the stools can be normal. It doesn't mean you have an infection with symptoms, obviously. So, yeah, you need to know what to look for when you develop the symptoms. I think that's what we can maybe focus on.
Yeah, so what are the symptoms?
Yeah, so it often starts off just like a normal flu. That will mean a bit of muscle aches, headaches and pains and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Nausea, quite pronounced nausea, a bit of diarrhea and stomach cramps. And obviously it can develop in immunocompromised people. Healthy people that have got reasonably decent hygiene practices won't get affected by this bacteria. It happens typically in the young children, whose immune systems aren't fully developed and maybe not eating healthy diets.
Mm-hmm.
So that they are susceptible. So are pregnant ladies. So pregnant women particularly, and then of course the elderly. And in young children, the danger is when the bacteria multiplies, it can spread via the blood to the brain, cause encephalitis, which is obviously the brain tissue itself, where it affects the neurons and the brain tissue.
Okay, so serious ramifications.
You die from the complications. Just like you die of the complications of flu-like illness or flu, so too, this, if not identified early, treated and diagnosed, can lead to those consequences.
Okay, so you've said that that heating is the magic bullet here. So it's making sure your food is cooked really
and storage of food.
Yeah,
so how are you storing your food? Are you leaving it out overnight and then having it the next morning? That, besides the gastro season, because we're speaking about summer health, is massive. Your sushi that you forget while having a bit of bubbly and sushi on the couch the night before, you have to put it in the fridge straight away if you're going to have it the next day. Don't take chances with poultry and meat products, even cured meats in the charcuterie, all those kind of things. You've got to be careful with those processed meats particularly. And then pastries and custards are also susceptible to temperature, like you won't believe. But that's more for food poisoning and that kind of thing. For Listeria itself, it's about preparing the food and not cooking it through properly.
Yeah.
So not heating the food adequately when using meat products. And then obviously where you're buying your milk and that kind of thing, if it's from a reputable place that goes through the stringent processes.
How is it treated if it is detected and it is becoming a problem? What is the treatment?
Sure. Quite simply, you are treated with an antibiotic that actually works against the bacteria. In most cases, there's an intravenous one called ampicillin.
Okay.
Very simple antibiotic that works quite well against it. In people that might be allergic to ampicillin, they'll use a common antibiotic called Purbac. Bactrim. So also important to know that a lot of the general antibiotics don't actually work against it specifically because of the specific qualities of the bacteria. So simple to treat and up to about a week or two. to 10 days normally, and in pregnant ladies sometimes even up to 2 weeks. So important to realize the populations at risk and the warning signs, and then also to take precautions with hygiene and hand washing and preparing surfaces and washing your vegetables properly.
Yep.
That kind of thing. I think that's what we need to remember.
Okay. So the we've also got to remember the water. So the solution is you have a bucket in the sink where you're washing your vegetables. You're catching the water afterwards to use it to flush the loo.
Use it. Yes. Don't throw it down the drain.
Just had to say that for the record. 100%. But it's really important. Don't let the water crisis be an excuse not to wash your hands often enough.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks very much. Happy to take calls on this topic, but we're also taking your general questions. We're talking summer health issues right now. Call us on 021-446-0567 if you have a question for Darren, or send an SMS 100%. To 31567. Obviously, when we talk summer, we talk sunshine and we worry about sun exposure. Darren?
Sun and swimming and outdoor sports and water sports, you know. So there are quite a few things. I think getting to the beach is a big one. So motion sickness always pops in there.
Yeah.
Your child the back seat moaning and groaning that their tummy's turning and they want to vomit in your car. Not a great feeling. So if you know children specifically are susceptible to motion sickness between the ages of 2 and 12 normally, problems actually in the ear, in maintaining equilibrium and balance with the horizon, don't let them read tablets and play games in the car if they get nauseous. Don't let them read. Don't let them sit at the back, provided they are of age where they legally are allowed to sit in front with the right kind of seating and so forth.
Seatbelts.
That's it. And then also obviously look at things like ventilation in the car and prep them with the right medication. There are lots of anti-emetics, anti-nausea agents that people use. I know some people take some valoid syrup with them on the long road when they're doing a road trip. It can save you a lot of trouble. Yeah. The problem with a lot of the meds obviously is they make you a bit groggy and drowsy. All those, that class of drugs generally do. You get the patch as well in adults for motion sickness and boat trips. Everyone wants to go yachting and sundowner cruising. So the patches, the scopolamine patches, I don't know if they're available in South Africa now. There was a period when they were a bit out of stock.
Okay.
So those are also useful as well. So remember that. And then, as you said, we moved on to the other things with sun exposure. The sun and light waves. I mean, you get long waves, you get short waves, and everyone knows about ultraviolet, UVA, UVB. And the easiest thing for you to remember is UVB is responsible for sunburn. There we go.
Yeah.
The B for burn. The A actually penetrates the different layers a little bit deeper and causes structural changes to some of the skin layer cells deeper down. And it alters the DNA makeup in the cell, which leads then to, uncontrolled proliferation and growth of those subdermal skin layers that can predispose basal cell cancer and so forth. So protect. And the SPFs, obviously, everyone wants to know about SPFs. There's 10, there's 20, there's 30. The 50s are great to use, but a sunscreen and a sunblock, understand that sunscreen is a barrier protection. Some of them have compounds in them that reflect the sun's rays. Others have things that absorb as well. Mm-hmm. And then others are actually aimed at the skin itself in terms of the nourishment of the skin and moisturizing and so forth as well, so you don't dehydrate the skin.
Yeah.
Combination of all those things, but we need to remember, most importantly, that, it's how often you apply it. So you go and swim in the water, a certain amount or percentage of that washes off in the salt water and when you're playing games and surfing and whatever. So reapplying it every half hour to an hour.
Okay, very, very important, that one. Thank you. Right, there's several questions and calls coming through. Anthea, I'll be with you in just a moment. But first, an SMS responding to your comment there about make sure the kids are old enough to be in the front seat if they are. And Gabby's SMS asking, what is the legal age for a child sitting in the front? Gabby, it's not about the legal age. It's about the height of the child. We've said this a couple of times over the last few weeks. But to recap what all the car seat activists tell us, that the front seat is the most dangerous place in the car for a child to be. A small child's body, if it's not developed enough, it is dangerous to have them there. They're at risk from the force of the airbags if they deploy.
The neck injuries.
They're at risk of neck injury. The seatbelt's structure and the way it's designed is not designed for a small body. Oh. 1.5 meters is the height that you're looking at. So if your child is less than 1.5 meters in height, they should not be in the front seat. And obviously that is going to be different age for different children and their development. But typically, it's kind of between the ages of 10 and 12 that they will hit that height. Don't even think about it if they're less than 1.5 meters. Anthea in Somerset West. Oh dear. I hope we can get her back again. I'm sorry, she was on hold for a while. We will try and call you back, Anthea. Kaz, thank you for your SMS asking about the symptoms of listeria. I think we've gone through them.
Yes, headache, nausea, fever, diarrhea, etc.
Okay, so thanks for your feedback, Kaz. And then keep calling 021-446-0567. Interesting one here, anonymous on the WhatsApp, asking, is it possible to be allergic to sand? Saying, my daughter's feet and ankles come up in a terrible rash on the beach on a warm day.
Yeah, some people have a chemical irritation, mm-hmm. And actually not a chemical so much, but a bit of a mechanical irritation. So I have seen patients, for example, that when they have abrasion, they just have hypersensitive skins. Mm-hmm. So walking in fine sea sand, for example, can cause irritation. Okay. Shells, and obviously walking in sand that's rich in crushed shells, I've also seen urticarial rashes. Yes. Those are allergic rashes in response to that as well. So you get irritation basically from the mechanical abrasion in some sensitive skins, but then you also get obviously the chemicals in this, in the actual sand itself, the salt content and what you've got. Remember this, I've actually met people that are actually allergic to kelp, which is one of the most natural products we get.
Oh gosh, I mean they use that.
So
in all
some
the
people are really unlucky, yeah. But anyway, so yeah, they're definitely quite a list of irritants rashes that can occur in sea sand. Definitely.
I think we've got Anthea back. Sorry about that, Anthea. Good afternoon.
Hi there. I would like to know, my hands were peeling, so that's finished peeling the inside. Now my feet are starting to peel. What on earth can that be?
Yes. So peeling hands or flaking hands, basically, where the skin peels off. Typically, it involves either a chemical dermatitis or a fungal infection. Those would be, and remember, we don't diagnose on the air. I can't see your hands right now. But obviously, we need to understand this, the groups of conditions. And dry, flaking skin, often fungal infections or chemical irritants like dishwashers, like shampoos that you might have used and changed. Think of the things that your hands and your feet are being exposed to. It might be because they're wet, moist areas that facilitates fungal growth quite easily. So have a look at that as well. Look at keeping your hands very dry. Use an antifungal agent.
Okay.
See if it makes a difference. They're very inexpensive, over the counter actually, that you can get some of them, and see how that goes. And then look obviously at the chemical irritants that you could be using, like creams, washing powders, all those kind of things.
Anthea, thanks for your call and good luck. I hope it comes right. Appreciate the call. 021-446-0567 is the number to dial. You can also do what Warren has done. Send an email to pippah@capetalk.co.za. Wanting a definitive answer, is there any truth to that thing about not swimming for an hour after eating?
Yeah, you mean for your stitch or the stomach cramp that happens? That's often the most common cramp. The common complaint is getting tummy cramps after. Yes. But that's exercising in general after just having a meal. I think a lot of people have a bit of indigestion and stomach cramps. Having a bit of what's called a stitch when you run, actually, which is on the side of in Afrikaans, it's called miltstiek, which is actually the spleen, the milt, because that's the area. It's normally because of the diaphragm having a bit of, obviously, a bit of spasm and pain. So people then regulate their breathing to get rid of a stitch as such. But, preferably don't go and swim immediately after eating a large meal. I suggest you give it a chance to digest.
Okay.
It's nothing about sinking. It's just about digestion.
Okay, thanks, Warren. All right. Great comment here from Sue. Sue, I think your mom and my mom attended the same first aid course because we had this as a remedy as well. Sue says when we had a tummy bug, my mom always used to give us flat Coke.
Yeah.
Okay, but wait for it. You make it flat by adding a spoon of sugar.
Yeah, I remember that.
My mom did the same thing. Of course, everyone's worried about the amount of sugar kids are consuming these days. What's the doctor's view on the flat Coke remedy?
Oh, geez. You know, so what you see the flat line, not flat line, the flat, really tired, pup, exhausted child in front of you, and you think they need some form of intake of calories.
Yeah.
So people want to get anything in, no matter what it is. But remember, if you spike the sugar levels up, they're going to drop within 10, 15 minutes, half an hour, that child's going to be really down there again.
Yeah.
So salt and vinegar crisps, I always recommend to some of my patients because it's potato, because it does contain calories. And the crisps and the salt obviously are involved with some electrolyte replenishment. And it makes them thirsty to drink water.
Which is so important.
As long as they're not vomiting with their gastro this season. So that's also important. If someone's vomiting and nauseous and they can't ingest any fluids, you first got to get rid of the nausea before you can rehydrate.
Yeah.
And if it happens for a prolonged period of time, time. They're not producing any urine, for example, and also they losing fluid constantly through their stools. They're going to need a drip. They're going to need a rehydration check. And for that, we look at the eyes, sunken in eyes. We look at the mouth for dry mouth with very little saliva. We look at the skin turgor, where we pinch the skin up and look if it shoots back and loses its elasticity or not. And then we ask about nappies or whether you're actually producing urine. Those are the things that guide you to whether you need a drip or not.
Okay. And rather err on the side of caution, I guess, is.
Put it in the hands of a practitioner or someone who works with children or with things like this all the time.
Okay. Wendy saying, I know we're meant to be sun smart and I do try, but occasionally you miss a spot and the tops of the ears, etc., get burned. What is the best remedy after the fact?
Yeah, that's very debatable because there's so many home remedies out there. I mean, there's fridge and there's ice and there's all these things. Some people use a tea tree oil, for example, as an anti-inflammatory agent afterwards. Some people take an anti-inflammatory medication, a tablet for the stinging and the pain and the redness and inflammation. Useful. Obviously, cold water packs, useful, ice packs immediately after that. Yeah. And then nourishing the skin with a decent moisturizer and aqueous cream and those kind of things are important.
That bottle of After Sun lotion I always keep just in case it does wonders. It really does try to just bring down the cooling immediately. Yeah.
I've even heard about vanilla essence. The scientific formulation as to why vanilla essence works quite well for burn wounds is quite interesting. I'm very interested in going to look that up.
Yeah.
And I'll get back to our listeners on that one.
Okay, we'll get back to you on the vanilla essence. We'll squeeze in one last call from Sue in Bergfleet. Sue, good afternoon.
Hi, Pippa. Yes, I was just listening to the doctor, and I just wonder if he can help me with this problem. I'm 60 years old, fit and healthy. I'm not on any medication.
Great.
And I go walking in the mountains with groups of friends.
Yeah.
And on the odd occasion, I'll be walking along, and then suddenly I can't see. Hmm. I get a kind of like, almost like the beginning of a migraine, but it's not a migraine, but it's kind of like a shaky dot in my vision, and it just gets bigger and bigger. It's as if I've been looking at the sun, and then I've come inside, and then you know that feeling where you can't see, everything's dark, and you just see this kind of shining imprint. And I don't know why that happens, and so I have to just stop and then breathe a bit, and then it kind of slowly fades away.
Yes.
Any idea?
Yeah, so really good. Oh, she describes the symptoms so beautifully.
So we are absolutely the doctor's favorite kind of patient.
If you want to go Google the stuff you're having, you can go look up a term called scotomas, where you have missing or blurred vision in certain patches of your visual field, S-C-O-T-O-M-A. And then visual scintillations is another word, and that's scintillations is S-C-I-N-T-I-L-L-A-T-I-O-N-S. And have a look at that. But what more importantly here is, why are you having these patches? And they're different. I mean, they're nerve causes, that demyelination of certain nerves, where the coating around the nerve and the optic nerve could be involved, especially in hot conditions. When you exercise and when you raise your core body temperature, one of them is called Lemaître's sign, and that's something that you might want to look up as well. I don't want to startle you with all the worst possible things it could be. It could just be that your sugar levels are dropping, you're a little bit hypoxic from being out of breath, and you're not breathing completely well. And also whether it's only with exertion, then one would look at the vasculature of the eye, look at whether the blood supply to the eye and the retina are actually working perfectly. Certainly, definitely, if you're having these symptoms, I recommend that you see an ophthalmologist and who has a look at your eye. Your eyes are precious and you shouldn't take any chances with them, especially if you're having intermittent visual loss.
And of course, because you want to be able to carry on walking, which will keep you fit and healthy post 60. Sue, thanks so much for your
call.
And good luck. Darren, always wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you.